I am Octavio, so that's what you call me. Today's session is called It May Be the Devil or It May Be the Lord, the religious dimensions of popular music. And the line comes from what we were just listening to, which is Bob Dylan's record Slow Train Comin' 1979, when he discovered Jesus in an Arizona hotel room and wrote a Christian album, Slow Train Comin'. And this is the opening song, Gotta Serve Somebody. Bob Dylan, of course, is Robert Zimmerman, born in Minnesota, a Jewish cat, Nobel Prize winner for literature, is it? Poetry. And it's interesting to take a Christian album from Bob Dylan, where the album is not particularly strong all the way through, but this litany of his, it doesn't matter who you are, or where you come from, or what you think, you're going to have to serve somebody, and maybe the devil. It's just interesting that a popular rock musician, in this case, folk rock, has a Grammy-winning Christian album in 1979, in which he details that it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. So, it's important that you ask questions as we go. I like questions, and they help us stay focused. So feel free at any point to ask questions. And of course, the meaning that we take away from today's session will be a product of everybody in the room, rather than just me talking. Or we're going to listen to some more music. I wrote a dissertation called The Long 1960s, The Religious Dimensions of Popular Music, and I set on this phrase, the religious dimensions of popular music, because you either need a lot more words to say it more clearly, and I have not found a way to say it with less. I'm trying to explore the way that popular music either functions as a religion for people, while also taking into account the religious implications of music in terms of where written notation comes from, how it's used in worship, the history of symphonies, and how the question of the sublime being touched on in music, it's the only way you can approach the sublime, the way that music communicates beyond words, the controversies throughout history about whether music is a corrupting force or whether music is in fact godly, let's say. And this is carried out in debates about organs, literally organs in the church. Is a church big enough for an organ to be in there? Do you need an organ to have godly music in church? Questions around, should women be able to sing? And there was a move away from allowing women to sing in church, 1700s, 1800s. And the question of, is the music competing with the minister, right? Is the music in the church distracting us from the pious act of contemplation that church is so famous for? But then there's questions about, music is a corrupting influence. We're going to hear a little bit about the devil in the music. So I am trying to look at this not in music as religion or music for religion, but what are some of the ways that popular music functions religiously for people. And I have a whole scholarly model, which we probably won't get into too deeply. Any questions so far? So then, of course, there's the question of, we say something is a religion or something is religious. What does that mean? A lot of people have definitions. What do you think religion is?
The rules about how we try and understand God.
Okay, rules about how we try to understand God. What else is a religion or religious religion?
A visiting person last week, one of her big things was she asked this question in hers, and I think we came up with this huge list, but what I said, and I still stand by, mm-hmm. is a collection, well, shared beliefs between people.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, like,
shared beliefs amongst people.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other burning ideas about religion?
To kind of question about anything?
I mean, you can take it within context of ask the question about religion. Beliefs about spirituality or morality, I would say. But not necessarily one or the other, you know.
And I like also that opens it up for... there's not a set value to religion in that definition. Right, shared beliefs could be anything, in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And as, no. Anything else?
There's something about it being a strict following, though. It's something more than just a casual acquaintance with a subject. It's strict and requires doctrine.
Okay, religion requires doctrine.
I was trying to put something together with the word doctrine in it, but or practice, mm-hmm. like spiritual practice or practices that have some kind of meaning or something like that.
So, practices that give or sustain meaning, or the idea of praxis, right?
Praxis, yeah.
Good. And, right, so part of the reason I ask these questions is I like to establish that there is no one answer to any of these questions. And I think people should be more open about that. We should say this is a definition that I'm using, or these are assumptions that I'm making. And one of the dimensions that I wrestle with is the question of doctrine and how important is it for a religious system. And here is... here's the most persuasive definition that I have found by Charles Long. For my purposes, religion will mean orientation. Orientation in the ultimate sense, that is, how one comes to terms with the ultimate significance of one's place in the world. And he goes on to say that... religion is not just prayers, for example. It embodies all kinds of areas of our life. Moving, singing, day-to-day practices, how you orient yourself and how you understand your relationship with the idea of the divine or the profane, and how you relate to other people. These are, I think, manifestations, active manifestations of what our orienting force is, right? And, good.
It just says one's place. It doesn't say anything about...
Yeah, not here. There's more. He has an entire thing on this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Just, he includes in that, talking about all the different ways that you... Religion should go beyond the idea of, oh, this is something that happens in church once a week kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And this is about how people make sense of themselves. And that becomes... of course, he's an African-American. He's talking about African-American religion in the United States. So there's a very... that part is not left out in any way of his work, and it's I'm very conscious of it with everything that I'm working on.
And that definition also kind of makes me think of... it sort of borders into philosophy. Like, I could see that describing what philosophy is, too.
Well, that's interesting, because the other definition that I like to include is by Jonathan Z. Smith, who says, religion is the quest within the bounds of the human historical condition for the power to manipulate and negotiate one's situation so as to have a space in which to meaningfully dwell. And I find this very persuasive when you look at history and the way that symbol, and that's what I was not going to say earlier, but the way, the relationship between Protestantism and segregation and sort of the Ku Klux Klan's identity and the defense of slavery through the Bible and all of these historical elements of injustice that are foundational to the United States and the way that they're defended from a Christian standpoint. And when you get into the early written arguments about slavery, for example, or the indigenous people, both sides are using Christian rhetoric to defend their position. So in a way, you can find a way to make the Bible say anything that you want. And we see this all the time, on and on. But what I think both of these historians of religion are talking about is how do you make sense of your context? And that's part of why I think music is so important, because it's used in so many ways. In many ways in my life, I found it to be an encouraging space, a space that allows me to live out things or locate or articulate things that I didn't have another way to say. It was a force that made sense of some of my experience in the world, right? But music is not just that. Music is many things. So it's this potential in terms of how do you come to terms with your existence. That's part of where I begin. Okay, but what is popular music?
Popular music is music being created in a specific time for a specific time and gaining traction in that time, you know?
Uh-huh. So it's contextual to a time and gets, it catches on in that time.
Mm-hmm. Just as someone who doesn't have a musical background, when you say it's being created for a time, what's an example of music that's not created for a time?
I guess created for, I that wasn't totally descriptive of what I was trying to say. Created for a time, like created for the current time maybe, which is kind of a loaded statement in and of itself, because, you know, there's no such, time doesn't exist in a vacuum either. So, I guess like popular music, if I scale back that definition I just gave, would be music that is popular in the time it's being made.
And we're going to be talking a lot more about that music made for a time tomorrow.
Okay.
Very, very specifically, so.
Thanks for adding that clarity.
Yeah, of course.
Any other ideas about popular music?
My first thought when you said it was just whatever the top 40 hit radio station is told to play, or, you know, so executives tell them to play, or.
mass consumption. Mm-hmm. Right?
That was just my initial thought.
Popular music now is changed by the internet and Spotify and access to music from different places than the radio. A while back when I was growing up, the radio determined what was popular. Mm-hmm. It played what was popular, and it kind of determined what was popular. People consumed it, and the styles changed to that age group all along, but with the internet, it's changed how you can find music. You can find music that you could never find before. Mm-hmm. And none of it's probably popular, but it's good.
And along with that, there's music that couldn't have been made before because it's using technology that didn't exist. Right. It's being distributed on a platform that didn't exist. And people are using different kind of... We're not carrying our phones with us, but our phones are a window to everything now. You can watch a whole album on your phone, right? That's different than sitting down and... Okay, quick side. Jerry Rubin, activist from the 60s, got into a debate with the Socialist Workers Party, and they had a debate, and the Socialist Workers Party guy got up and talked for 30 minutes in a clear vision of why socialist America was important. And Jerry Rubin got up and put a gramophone on the table and played a Bob Dylan record. And when he got to the end of the Bob Dylan song, everyone thought he was going to explain it. And so he flipped the record over and played another Bob Dylan song. And that was his argument. So what is popular music? We're talking about this. So when you get into the theorists of what popular culture is, they're talking about, right, these are academics talking about high culture and low culture. But it's not just academics. We've had throughout history saying, well, opera is high culture and comics are low culture. And so people making all these distinguishing judgments about the aesthetic value and what it means to participate in certain kinds of culture. And so some people would say, I guess they'd call it high culture is like the opera, low culture is like folk culture, and McDonald's is popular culture. So popular culture, is it mass produced? Is it something that is mass produced for mass consumption? It is designed to be on a huge level, to be consumed at a huge level. Is it something that's pleasing to everyone? Everybody likes it. That's why it's popular. So it's not just mass consumed. It's popular in the sense that everybody can jump on a piece of it or make whatever meaning they want. And then, of course, the question of, well, is popular culture shallow? Does it have any of the value that high culture has or comes out of a folk tradition? It's played over and over and over again, and people criticize popular culture as having no integrity. And that's why I put these questions together, is to say popular, when we use the frame popular, it doesn't necessarily mean any of this. But it's tremendously influential in terms of how people think about themselves. And we're going to talk about this more tomorrow also, in terms of, well, a band comes along, or an artist comes along and dresses in a certain way, they play a music in a certain way, and then everybody emulates them. Not everybody, many people emulate them. The Beatles changed the way that music was made in Europe, in the United States, as well as hairstyles and clothes. And their records sold a lot for a record industry, right? So all of these layers. And then the famous John Lennon says that the Beatles are bigger than Jesus, and there's this great pushback in the United States against the Beatles. It's worth noting that he said that at least a year before anybody got upset. And I was just reading an article where the Soviet media referred to the Beatles as being bigger than Jesus. So. Okay. But so part of when I talk about the religious dimensions, I really think that music is a space, or music can create a space, right? Because music exists in your memory, or if you're a musician, it exists in your mind all the time. Or even if you're just somebody that listens to music, you remember times and places when you heard a song or how it made you feel. And music can then create an emotion. It can evoke an emotion. It can make you sad or happy or energized or angry. And it's possible, part of the reason that music's so controversial in the religious setting is because it's clearly capable of generating, or I think evoking is the best word, evoking a response. And this is why there's a debate around music in church, or music as the devil's music in the saloon is attracting the young people away from the church, right? So I find this to be very persuasive. This guy, he's a musicologist. He presents the idea of an audiotopia, which he calls the space within and produced by a musical element that offers the listener and or the musician new maps for reimagining the present social world. So music is a form of thought, but it's a creative act. It can function like a possible utopia for the listener. Music is experienced not only as sound that goes into our ears and vibrates through our bones, but as a space we can enter into, encounter, move around in. And this we'll talk more about tomorrow, but I always like to bring up Bernice Johnson Reagan. She's a civil rights singer, scholar, activist from the civil rights movement, and she always spoke about the sound vibrating through your body. And she said that when you sing a song, you change your condition. You cannot sing a song and not change your condition. And she talks about, I couldn't find this on DVD. I really wanted to bring it and show it, but it's impossible to get. She talks about when they were protesting the civil rights movement and they would sing a song, it claims the space. So the police or the National Guard would have to come through your sound in order to arrest you or grab you. And you were chained, you were claiming that space. And she was claiming that space in a certain way, using the music of her tradition. And also the act of singing was a way of announcing, we are going to change this country and the world and ourselves all at once. And so the sound is something that creates that change. So when you couple that, whenever I see Josh Kuhn's Audiotopia, I'm always thinking about Bernice Johnson Reagan. And she also says, since we don't have the video, she says, once you sing, you're out there. Everybody can hear you. There's no hiding anymore. And Bernice Johnson Reagan is very much talking about using songs in the civil rights movement for transformation. And so this is, again, why I use the idea of religious dimensions, because music is, music can be used in all kinds of ways. There's some music that is very clearly not religious at all. This is stuff that you hear in ads or in background soundtracks. Music in the elevator, it's designed to placate people. It's designed, or it's used, to give you an impression of something. And then, of course, there's, you know, extreme political music that has a very political message. And you may not like the political message, but you might like the music, or you might not like it either. The point is, music has an effect, and it can be used in many different ways. And that's, for me, a very important part. I don't see music as religion, or even music as religious. I see it as a space of potential. And never mind. Okay. But then one of the pieces that I'm always thinking about is, how does music relate to the church? The first printed book in North America was the Bay Song Book, the song book for the Massachusetts Bay Colony. It's 1638 or something. It was the first printed book in what becomes the United States, was a book of songs. Partly because the Bible was too big to print at that point. Anyway, but more than that, how does music relate to worship or the encounter with the orientation, with the divine, with the idea of a creator? So Robin Sylvan says, music and religion are intimately linked in almost every culture and in almost every historical period. And it's interesting when you find people that don't really separate everyday life. They don't say religion is separate from the act of living. Songs and music are not even thought of as separate. So it's kind of like, well, do you have feet, you can dance. Do you have a voice, you can sing. And if you have those things, you can relate to the divine, the great mystery, so to speak. And I spent some time with the Maya in Guatemala, and I guess I was deeply persuaded by their relationship with the natural world and the cycle of rainy, dry, dry season and rainy season, and the way that things grew during the rainy part of the year and things didn't during the dry part of the year. And they didn't make a distinction between their ritual, spiritual or religious life and their everyday effort to survive. And that influenced the way that I think about this. So that's just important to include. So I'm deeply persuaded by the fact that religion has often gone hand in hand or accompanied by music. And you see this in the Hebrew Bible if not before. And already at some point there's debates about, oh, is this a distraction? Is this a corrupting influence? Right? So then some of the earliest forms of musical notation as we know it today were developed by an Italian monk in the 10th century to help his choir boys to distinguish the tones and semitones of which the modes are constructed. And this is interesting when we're talking about as well with musicians, is the actual act of writing music down so that somebody else could read it, as opposed to just hearing it or singing it from memory, it's like a language, right? And so the development of this as a technological advancement comes out of, we need the choir boys to be able to sing together. So they developed how to write it down. And this is why music as a space, a potential space, is so important to me, because music can be on the page. It's not heard yet, but some people can, something will happen when they look at that. And other people, it's just marks on the page. And then, of course, the idea of composing something, well, it exists somewhere inside of you in relation to outside of you, and the act of writing it down versus just playing it. So, where I go to with this is, especially in the United States, and it's not unique, you can look directly at many of the early, in the 20th century, many of the popular musicians, recording artists, learned to play in the church. They were deeply influenced by church music, specifically. But more than that, when you look at tunes, harmonies, songs do not just come out, you know, we just sing it over here and nobody else hears it. People hear tunes and harmonies. And so songs, popular songs, are being set with new religious lyrics. And religious songs are changed with new popular lyrics, secular lyrics. And people are trading tunes and sounds and ways of thinking about music all over the place. And so there's always going to be a relationship between music in worship and music as entertainment. And the two overlap. And we'll also see with the civil rights movement or with any social movement, traditional songs or other songs can be changed with lyrics directly relating to this time and place for a hope for a change. So, Mahalia Jackson, for example, says, I believe that blues and jazz and even the rock and roll stuff got their beat from the sanctified church. So you have Mahalia Jackson is not alone in saying this. If you look at a list of sort of many of the early recording artists in the 20th century, they all say the same thing. Paul Simon said when he first came across rock and roll, it sounded like the gospel songs that he'd grown up with. And so people making this connection over and over, the call and response element, the rhythms, some of the instruments, this is a basis for, and right, there's obviously a difference between a hymn sung in church, specifically out of the hymn book, and something recorded, put on record, sold, bought, traded, heard on the radio, requested, or now is it on Spotify? I just found a record by T.L. Barrett and the Youth Choir for Christ, Like a Ship Without a Sail, that I'd never heard before. And it's not really popular music in the common sense, because they're the youth church choir for Christ. But there's so many elements that you can recognize in this, as well as to just range very widely. The way that specific musicians or rock stars are looked up to or idolized in a way. So here we go. The calls and responses between Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions came straight from the churches of Chicago's South Side, and those sounds had their origins in the slave songs and coded spirituals crafted in the centuries-old struggle for freedom. Craig Werner's a musical cultural historian, and once again, this argument is that popular music in the 20th century in the United States draws directly from, in this case, the African American experience in the Americas, and the Black Church and Black Church songs and other church songs and the relationship between the actual church space and the so-called secular space, which I'm also not persuaded that these are really separate, as I've pointed to already. So in this case, the songs are traveling back and forth between these places. And so even a very, the argument then boils down to the fact that you could have a totally secular, popular song that says, oh, this has nothing to do with religion. And this argument is there are still traces of the religious impulse in those popular records. And it happens in a historic way, which you can trace. Right, I meant to take this one out. But we're going to talk more about this tomorrow, Freedom Songs and the Civil Rights Movement. But since we're here, let's talk about it now. A big part of the Civil Rights Movement was the Freedom Songs and singing in church, and we're going to see more about this. But so, the Freedom Songs were often directly drawn from hymns or interpreted from church songs. The lyrics changed, the meaning changed. And of course, the Civil Rights meetings and marches often began and ended in churches. So they were literally singing religious songs, going out into the street, confronting the police or the National Guard or the Ku Klux Klan or just racists, and singing these songs together. So that's another model to think about, the way that early songs that come out of a certain context are recorded and interpreted and then become popular. And we're going to talk about this tomorrow. Black secular music conveys the evolving religious consciousness of African Americans in the 20th century. And again, we've touched on this. Music as a space of thought, revealing how you understand yourself. But music also reflects the technology of a time. For example, the early origins of what we call country music in the early 20th century was basically white folks singing the blues. And the way that you became a country music, it was not country music yet. This label comes out of a post-McCarthy era when they had labeled all of the folk singers as communists. And so folk became synonymous with communism. And so they needed a way to talk about this style of music without evoking communism. So this is where the idea of country music comes from. You look at the early country music, as I say, there's a huge overlap with, obviously, folk music, but also the blues. And that is to say that if you were a musician in this era, the only way you could make a living was to perform live. You didn't get paid to perform on the radio, but it was harder to get an audience if people didn't recognize you or hadn't heard about you. So. And obviously this goes from, if everybody has an acoustic instrument, you can only hear it so far away. But once it becomes electrified, it changes the entire context. And that's before you have recording. And you already mentioned electronic music, digital music. And what I'm trying to say here is recorded music reflects the technology of the time and the way that it's consumed. And so, again, the early country music, or early folk music, Western music, directly relates to the radio. And that's, do you know what the Grand Old Opry is? What's the Grand Old Opry?
It's in Nashville. Isn't it in Nashville?
It is in Nashville. But what is it?
I thought it was a radio program.
It was a radio program. Now it's a building, I guess. The Grand Old Opry was a radio show in barns. So all I'm trying to say here is that music captures the time and the place and speaks to the technology of. And technology, of course, also speaks to how we imagine, how we think, what we can, what you can imagine.
So would you say there was popular music before there was a way to reach a mass audience?
So the point about the mass audience has to do with theoreticians on what popular culture is. And they're always talking about, well, you can't have popular culture without this kind of mass consumption. But I definitely see an element of popular also indicates the people, right? And so what, and I would hesitate in some way to say, well, music that gives a group meaning, a small group, like the Holden Village, the Holden Evening Prayer, right? This is widely recognizable to many people. And it reminds them of a place and a time, or many times in a place, right?
And it was also written for a group of people for that time.
Exactly. No doubt here as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
But it wasn't intended to...
So it was like a liturgy for a moment...
Yeah,
right, conceived of in that way.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to distinguish is even though it is now disseminated and widely known, it still has a very specific meaning to a group of people in a place. And people that come to the place and then go away, they remember, because like my domestic supervisor, Anna, she was always telling me about the Holden Evening Prayer before... I ever heard it, and I've heard it in other places, and yet I've never heard it as powerfully as this summer when we did it in the building
village
over there.
Center.
In the village center, when the whole village chimed in together, and it was, you know, something happened in the room there. But in answer to your question, I want to say that you could say that because of the way that this song or this musical performance has meaning for a group. That certainly speaks to what I would consider to be... That's certainly implied by popular. Not in the... And that's why I always put the series of questions. Popular doesn't mean X. Popular points to possibilities. And yet when... Not that we have record stores anymore, but they used to have this section called pop, and it stands for popular music, and that's not... what do they put in that category, right?
Anything that would sell.
Anything that would sell.
What is funny is popular, if you like music and you like certain genres of music, there's levels of music that you'd be ashamed to say that you like popular music.
Right.
Whereas I like jazz, or I like bluegrass, but mm-hmm. nobody wants to admit, except teenagers, that they like popular music.
And yet it's a tremendous force in the market.
Yeah.
Of entertainment, which is also, you know, hip-hop's an excellent example, which obviously draws on a lot of the things we've already spoken about. You don't have hip-hop without a lot of earlier iterations of cultural production, let's say. But when hip-hop went from being sort of localized to being a mass mover in the world of commerce... it was no longer a set-aside genre, if there ever was such a thing to begin with. But it's interesting the way a genre can develop and suddenly become hugely popular. So, and this is, I want to just, since I'm talking about hip-hop, I want to draw on this point again, that popular music has these sort of origins in a ritual setting. And that goes back 1,000 years, it goes back 2,000 years, it goes back on and on. People making music in relation to worship. Music done as a form of entertainment. There's a connection there, even if it's implicit rather than explicit. Okay, and a big part of music, well, I guess we should take a quick aside. So, the symphony was thought of as the highest form of creative work that could ever be achieved at a certain time in Europe. And there was a debate about, well, if it was in Italian, would it still be as pure as the German symphonies? And it can be argued that Beethoven changed the way that people thought, and not just thought about music, the way that they thought in general, the way they considered music is capable of expressing ideas. My understanding is prior to Beethoven, the idea was music could not express ideas, only words could express ideas. And Beethoven's symphonies changed the way that people approached music, as well as connecting to the idea of a German, and obviously Germany was not a country so long ago, the idea that Germany had an identity and that German people had an identity that was expressed by Beethoven's music. And the symphony, the highest attainment of possible human creativity. This is all in a book called Music as Thought by Mark Evans, Mark Bond is his name. Music as Thought. And obviously with symphonies, and in that context, there has to do with music as a form of recognition of God. It's for God. It's an effort to create a sublime experience. This is very much a driving assumption in some of this operatic works and symphony and all of this kind of stuff. It's aimed at a higher purpose. It's not just entertainment. It was never thought of as just entertainment. And so that's interesting as well when you look at this in contrast with something that's played 100 times a day. And that's all before we get to MTV and music videos. I know they don't play music videos anymore, but music videos began as a form of advertising. It was a way to advertise a record. And then it became an art form all of its own. And then, I don't know, now it's something they release on YouTube. So. And all of this, I'm trying to say, relates to, we go back to Long's definition, the idea of people's efforts to orient themselves and to provide or find meaning, to make sense of the difficult human condition. Good. So I want to talk briefly about listening. Right, because music is listened to, right? People find meaning in it. And so there's three very interesting historic examples. You know who Huey Newton was? Who was Huey Newton?
I can't remember, but I know his name.
Okay, anybody? So Huey Newton was the co-founder of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in Oakland, California. And we're not going to talk too much about them today. Huey Newton, when they articulated their 10-point program for the Black Panther Party, while he was doing this, he was listening to Bob Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited. It's a Bob Dylan album, Highway 61 Revisited. And Huey Newton was listening to this record over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And a number of people that were there at the time talk about having Huey Newton explain Bob Dylan's music. And this is what all these things mean. And he's explaining the condition that Huey Newton and his comrades found themselves in Oakland. There's a whole history there. The point that I want to make here is Huey Newton heard something in Bob Dylan's record that related to his articulation of a plan to change the way that blacks were treated in America. And he heard it in Bob Dylan. And Huey Newton's not the only person to interpret Bob Dylan like this. There's A.J. Weberman, who started the Dylan Liberation Front, designed to liberate Bob Dylan from himself. And he published a book translating Bob Dylan. I don't think Bob Dylan cared for A.J. Weberman.
Self-appointed therapist.
But another example is James Baldwin listening to Bessie Smith. Who was James Baldwin?
Black author.
A black author? Anybody else? So James Baldwin was an author, yes. You should find out more about James Baldwin. Side note, James Cone explained that Martin Luther King kept him Christian, Malcolm X kept him black, and James Baldwin kept him human. So, side note for you there. James Baldwin described listening to Bessie Smith and hearing in her music. As I recollect it, he found a way to reconcile his experience as a black gay man in America and all the things that that meant at the time. And so what we're talking about here is people hearing in music something that they're able to use, or rather that reflects part of their struggle or their experience. And this to me is, you could say, well, this is not religious. Well, maybe not, but it does have to do with an ultimate concern in the terms of, this world doesn't make sense to me. I feel unreconciled with the things that happen around me and the way that things function, and maybe even who am I? And hearing in some of these tunes and songs and vocal expressions something that gives, articulates part of that meaning. And that's something that popular music is used all the time to do. Perhaps not at this level. I like the Phil Lesh example. Who was Phil Lesh?
0-for-3.
He's in the Grateful Dead, right?
He was the bass player for the Grateful Dead. Yeah. And Phil Lesh describes a lot of things. He says they were playing a show one day and they really felt that they'd played badly. And, their musicianship was important to them, and whether they could hear each other and so forth. And he said that the fans were going crazy, and, oh my God, this is the greatest show ever. And he said that he started to lose respect for his own fans because they were not critical of what they had just experienced. And he was like, why are we doing this if these people don't even appreciate it? And yet that also speaks to a kind of... Some of my other work has to deal with the religious dimensions of the Grateful Dead subculture and music, and so it's hard to judge people finding a life-altering significance in the music of the Grateful Dead, even if it's not played well. Something important is happening for those people. And, obviously, Grateful Dead music is important to Phil Lesh. He's dedicated his entire adult life to it as an enterprise. So. Any questions?
I see in popular music, or the music I'm listening to because I'm stuck up here, is satellite radio. And satellite radio has a station called the Coffee House, which is all acoustic. And I was listening to all the songs on it. I can sit and listen for quite some time because I like to listen to music. Almost 99% of the songs are love songs. There's not much political or... anti-war or anything other than love songs. I mean, that's just one particular source of music, but some of the people that I listen to that are less well-known do sing folk music. Mm-hmm. They do sing about the current situation that we're in. So, I don't dislike this other music. I like it a lot, but it's a product, I guess.
And I guess considered also the ways that it's accessible to many different people. Whatever your position is on anything,
the company I guess couldn't sell a product that might be controversial to most of or half of the world. Maybe that's what it is. But
and everybody can feel empathy. Well. Anybody can potentially feel empathy for some sort of love song, either liking somebody or unrequited love. These are potentially common experiences. And this is something brief aside, I have a radio program called the Flower Power Variety Hour, where I play music for perilous times. And a lot of that for me deals with countercultural music or music from the civil rights movement, the Black Liberation Movement. But since it's hard to play all those songs all the time, part of the reason I say perilous times is, well, what other sort of experiences are people having, and how does it relate to right now, when so little of the music seems to have a political consciousness or be aware of sort of the consequences of all this. And so, as well as the vast majority of the music that I have is by male artists, and it's difficult to always include a wider variety, let's say. And so it's just interesting the extent to which so much music is about this. A huge majority of music has to do with love songs in one way or another. Is it a marketing thing? Is it about the human condition? Is it about entertainment?
About all of them.
It's about all of them. Good. Any other questions at the moment?
So what happens to the folk singers, Bob Dylan, and the writing, Paul Simon, he still writes and he still sings, but some of the people that had the greatest messages in music aren't writing much that I know of.
Well, and then, people say a genre is dead all the time, right? But then there's the question of, well, is rock actually dead? Because all of the rockers are dying or died already.
Hell no.
No, not at all.
But then the classic rock thing, right? So it's an interesting, and this brings to the question of what is the role of artists in society, and to what extent does art imitate life versus life imitate art, and what happens to the kind of, let's say, the creative mind, but somebody who is wrestling with eternal questions. And that's one of the things I... Let's do it. Let's do it. Okay. So, I was going to talk about this a little later, but we're going to talk about it now, because it's perfect. Who is Kurt Cobain?
Frontman of Nirvana.
Nirvana is an example of a band that changed the way that music was made and listened to, and it's identified with an area of the world. It has a lot of meaning in Seattle, even though they're from Aberdeen, Washington. Where is Aberdeen, Washington?
By
Kent. Most depressed county in the state of Washington.
The most depressed county in the state of why?
Logging. It's gone.
Aberdeen had a specific industry that gave it its meaning at a time, and that industry has faded, and Aberdeen has been destroyed by that over the last 50 years or more. So, I was not a Nirvana fan. I am not a Nirvana fan, though I came of age along with this music. And we were going on a trip to the peninsula, the Olympic Peninsula in Washington, and we saw the sign for Aberdeen, and it said, "Come as you are." And I was like, "Isn't that a Nirvana song?" And I believe my domestic supervisor knew that he was from Aberdeen, and then we saw a sign for Kurt Cobain Landing. And being a religious scholar, I wanted to see a pilgrimage site here. Such existed. So we went, and it's this spot next to this river where Kurt Cobain claims to have lived under the bridge as a youth. And Aberdeen was rough. It was a very depressed place. And so what we found there was this sort of shrine to Kurt Cobain. And it's a very, the space is kind of has a split personality in that there's these different plaques and different statues, and they don't really agree on what they're saying or why they're saying it. But what really impressed me was I don't have a picture of, there's a picnic table there, and these people carved all this stuff into it. You know, I came here from Russia to see you, Kurt, or, you know, you changed my life, or with love from England, Billy, you know. But then underneath the bridge there, there's all of this graffiti. And what I was really, what struck me was, here were people had traveled to this place to try and decided they wanted to leave a mark on the place, kind of like the mark that they had that had been left on them by Kurt Cobain and his music. And the reason we got on Kurt Cobain and his music was you were asking about what happens to some of these artists. And that's, Kurt Cobain was expressing something in a way that people felt that they could relate to. And Kurt Cobain, for one way or another, was consumed in the process. And he died at age 27 by committing suicide. And that incident also has a kind of controversy or appeal to people. As an example, or as something, as a cautionary tale. The point is, what I saw in this place was, these were people that had come there, and they were trying to make sense of their lives. And their relationship with this music and this voice was something that provided them some direction. And the same way, I was drawn to the place because I was interested in what was happening. And seeing this kind of physical remnants of people trying to come to terms with what it meant. And that's part of why I talk about the religious dimensions of this. Because what does it mean for people to orient themselves towards a musician? In this case, it's not just a musician. People call them a spokesman for a generation. I liked his response to that. He said, I'm not a spokesman for anything. Something along the lines of, I don't know what's going on. People that look at me and think I know what's going on, they don't understand. He's just trying to articulate his own experience.
Is that what they call them, idols?
And that's another wrinkle in this whole thing of when you think that a musician or a rock star is a god. And, right, this also ties into the entire idea of So, in the 1960s, John Sinclair, anybody know who John Sinclair was? He was the manager for the MC5, a band from Detroit, the Motor City 5, and he was also the founder of the White Panther Party, the Rainbow People's Party. And John Sinclair wrote this thing about rock and roll being a weapon of cultural revolution. And he talked about how this was the thing that was going to give people back their sense of themselves and maybe bring down the Western Empire. And he thought that music was a tool and a weapon for social change. And at the same time, you'd have sort of his counterpoints saying that music was trying to destroy the youth culture and rock and roll was going to corrupt the youth and then music, rock and roll music was a tool of the communist efforts to destroy the West. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting the way that both sides of this argument put in music the power to destroy a civilization. And that's a common theme, right, is the music is threatening our children. And that's one of the reasons why I also think Kurt Cobain's so interesting is, they sold 10 million records with their second album. And they're a grunge band from Aberdeen, Washington. It changed the way that music was made in that entire genre. And yet here's a guy who killed himself. And there's a story of him being in Italy, and he climbed up on top of the speakers and was like, I'm going to jump, and all the audience is going, do it, do it. So what's the relationship between the fans and the artist? And what was he reconciling? And so, right, we'd say, well, Nirvana can make people go crazy. You know, there's direct evidence of that in this case. Let's see. And I just wanted to give you one other piece of this memorial. Unfortunately, there's the picnic table with all of the carving on it. And again, there's all kinds of graffiti, people talking about, Kurt changed my life. And I don't also get the sense that a lot of the people that come there are doing it with a kind of false expectation that Kurt is God or something like that. But it was a very personal encounter with the space and an effort to make sense of it all. Because life is confusing. Even without all of the repressive and depressive aspects of our modern society. So, certainly. Okay. So, there's obviously a historic element, as I've already said, from gospel songs, field songs, into hymns and spirituals, and I guess it goes the other way. Spirituals and hymns lead to gospel songs, leads to blues, leads to rock and roll music, leads to heavy metal music. There's an element of hip-hop that draws on all of this popular music, incorporates themes and sounds of all of these levels. All of which this, the guy Robin Sylvan that we mentioned before, he has an argument that all of popular music contains traces of West African possession ritual rhythms. He says that popular music has as a basis some of the rhythms that come, that were brought over by slaves, the rhythms from these West African possession rituals. And his framework is he calls them traces. So, as we've already said, popular music can have nothing to do with religion whatsoever, but the argument is that there's still these pieces in there, subliminally, that come from these rhythms. And then you have people saying things like Alberta Hunter saying, to me the blues are, well, almost religious. The blues are like spirituals, almost sacred. When we sing blues, we're singing out our hearts. We're singing out our feelings. Maybe we're hurt and just can't answer back. Then we sing or maybe even hum the blues. Yes, to us the blues are sacred. When I sing, I walk the floor, wring my hands and cry. Yes, I walk the floor, wring my hands and cry. What I'm doing is letting my soul out. And that's, just to keep it nice and confusing, this is part of what, when I started to look into Kurt Cobain more deeply, I would hear, listening to some of the sound, referencing Bernice Johnson Reagan, the sound of his voice. This was somebody, this white guy from Aberdeen, Washington, was sharing some of what Alberta Hunter is talking about. And I think that that's part of what the people that went to the Kurt Cobain landing were feeling as well. And so that's also, we spoke about love songs a little while ago. What does it mean when this is the thing that is drawing people to it? This kind of deep anxiety and wrestling and pain. This is something that I relate to that I don't have other words for. So, and isn't that part of what church and religious activity speaks to, is the experience of uncertainty, confusion, looking for answers, etc. Not to confuse everything, Alberta Hunter is talking about singing the blues and the lyrics and articulating something that she experienced. And again, we're going to talk more about that tomorrow also. So, I have done this work on the religious dimensions. And do you want to hear about this, or should we move on?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, this guy, Ninian Smart, English character, I guess he was in Santa Barbara for a long time, he put out 7 dimensions that deal with the nature of a religion. That was his question was, what is something that is in common of a religion? And he has 7 of them, which I am working with, but I have shifted some of them. What I've been talking about a lot today is the genealogical dimension. And this has to do with the relationship between genres and forms of music. It's very rare that somebody just comes up with something that's never been heard before. They're drawing on what's gone before, and there's seeds of all of these earlier religious songs and attitudes that travel throughout human history and human musical composition and the sharing of songs, and I heard a tune and you heard a tune and we put them together and make a new tune. That's the genealogical part. There's a family resemblance, right? And just recognizing that part. There's the ritual and practical dimension. That's song as ritual, song that accompanies ritual, rhythms of rituals that give shape or a feeling to a certain song. You sing a song during certain parts of a worship service. It clearly has a ritual aspect. Or certain songs that remind you of a place or that you sing to put you in a certain state. Right? And there's also it's something that you do. And of course, that speaks to the experiential dimension. And that has to do with, we spoke about it with the symphony, we've spoken about it with the blues, we've spoken about it with Kurt Cobain, how it makes you feel. And the idea of that somebody can go to a Grateful Dead concert and say there's a dictionary called Skeleton Key, a dictionary for deadheads. And the people interviewed talk about a Grateful Dead deity that would come out during part of the show. It was often triggered by a little musical thing that Jerry Garcia would do. He was the guitarist for the Grateful Dead. And talking about this religious experience that happens at a Grateful Dead concert. Now, I don't think that that's isolated from many different forms of music.
Is Skeleton Key like a physical thing that would come out on stage at a dead show?
No.
Okay. I thought it was LSD.
No.
I'm just saying, there's plenty of it.
It's in there. But the point is, people describe this as there's a Grateful Dead deity, like a number of people have. And, you know, in terms of, you look back at Charles Long's and Jonathan Smith's definition, people are defining themselves towards the Grateful Dead. The point is, the experiential dimension is the way that music can make you feel, like you're encountering the sublime. Think about the symphony. The only way that we can begin to express our love or appreciation, our dependence upon God, is through a symphony, for example. And that's why people are... That's why music continues to be a concern. And they say, oh, this is corrupting the youth. This is driving the people crazy. And yet we never take music as, well, hey, this is a really healing, positive part that brings the community together. This is capable of healing us all. I guess that doesn't sell in the media as well. This is capable of bringing us all together. But saying, oh my God, it's threatening your children's minds. We can all get behind that. And then the performative dimension. I think about performance as it's something that you do for a reason. It's something carried out. But the idea of it being a performance is not to say that I want you all to see me do this. What I mean by that is it's something that's done for a reason, and in the doing you also give it meaning. Right? Performing it is part of what makes it significant. And this also ties to, right, the actual playing of music versus the specific listening to music. And right, again, it's not to say that all music has this religious meaning. Somebody can get up and play something purely for entertainment, or in certain political situations, this music is aimed at creating a sentiment, usually of resentment against the sort of ethnic or cultural minority, or presenting a certain kind of propaganda of a national identity that's not positive. And then we were talking to
I have to stoke.
Very good.
Sorry. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for doing that.
Good.
Wait, can you, sorry, before you move on, what? I sort of didn't understand what you, the last thing you said. Which,
performative?
Did you explain it as orientation?
Sure. So, this is part of my question is people say that religion has to have a doctrine. And especially when you look at somebody like the Grateful Dead, you have people who orient themselves as deadheads. You can define this term as people for whom the Grateful Dead provide meaning, or who share in this experience, and it gives shape to how they live out their lives, right? Mm-hmm. But you would be much harder pressed to say that the Grateful Dead have a doctrine. In fact, their basic doctrine was, we're not going to tell you how to do anything. Like, just show up, take part. That's the rule. There's no rules. We create an environment, and you're supposed to be there if you want to. And so that's one of the things I'm sort of continuing to wrestle with, is how much do you need a set of rules to provide somebody with a meaning that speaks to their deeper sense of who they are? And without getting into volunteerism and all of that, the question of how does this make your life better? But not really, that's what I'm saying. How do you understand yourself through this music? Like, so one of the sayings that I've always found persuasive is, you know, hip-hop saved my life. And what I take that to mean is you heard a song, you heard an artist, and suddenly all of this stuff that was happening to you became clearer. You didn't feel so all alone. And suddenly you understood yourself more fully as a person in the world. In a sense, that's certainly something that happened to me. When I was 13, I heard Tupac Shakur. He was a rapper slash actor. And in the first record, Holler If You Hear Me, I, as a 13-year-old in America, as a Mexican-American person, I didn't understand the things that were happening to me. And suddenly, it became much clearer to me that this, I was not alone having these experiences, and that there were actual explanations for some of why this was happening. Now, that's not to say that, the point is to say that it becomes a way for you to negotiate more fully who you are and who you want to be. And so, rather than as a statement, it's a question. Does music provide orientation? Can music provide orientation? And what are some ways that we could think about that? Rather than just as, it's corrupting the children, or, it's great entertainment, or, I'll fight you because you don't like Lady Gaga, or whatever it is. So, in a sense, to take music more seriously. And Grail Marcus, music journalist for Rolling Stone, he describes, interestingly, he's reviewed music for 40 years, and he describes like getting death threats for giving bad reviews to bands, and how, you know, upset people get about this.
Please finish your point. I had about,
I think it was basically implied.
I think that a common thread I'm sort of hearing from you is that in the musical experiences, you're sort of talking about that are transformative, that maybe start to border on this religious experience, there's a part of it that almost seems essentially like somebody helps you know yourself and understand yourself in a context that doesn't recognize your experience. So there is sort of like an essential rebellion against the parts of our society that are oppressive and don't work. Is that something that, like, am I hearing that correctly? And is that something you think applies to all religious experiences outside of just the musical context?
So that is something that I am saying, yes. And yes, and I mean, that's part of my, it's part of my thing about like education and thought is, these things are supposed to matter. And what I mean by that is if it's not relevant, like we spend all this time alienating people from their own sense of like, you are important and your experience is important. And the information and the things that we provide people with, I think it's bad when we communicate to people, you know, switch off. This doesn't, you know, you don't matter. And so, you know, that's definitely implied in my point here is when a system of thought or belief serves to divide us or disenfranchise us in terms of our own sense of self and our ability to come together, I don't think that that's good. And so, but I'm also, this is something that I'm very, again, it's why I call it the religious dimensions. Nothing is good or bad or essential. Everything is about potential. And so religion as a structure, religion as a praxis can be used in many different ways. And so I'm not going to say that like a religion that I don't agree with is not religious for people, and that's why I always try to keep it in this questioning space. But part of what I'm saying here, and that's not to say that music, again, music is not going to save us. Music's not going to fix everything. Music's not always good. Music has potential. And one of the potentials that I see is for spiritual experience, it's for transmitting ideas and beliefs, and it's a space of potential, as Josh Kuhn would say, a space that you can move around in, you can be safe in. So music is not X, music is a potential space. And I have a whole other thing about music as existing before it's, music exists before you write it down or hear it. But music also exists as you remember it. And music also exists as something you hear or play. Music also exists as something that, you know, accompanies society. And since we probably don't have time, there were two pieces of music that I would like to play, one of which I didn't bring, the Popula Meus. So Rudolf Otto, do we know who he was? German theologian who developed the idea of the holy. And he talks about, he's drawing on Schleiermacher, and Schleiermacher's creature feeling, which is the feeling that one gets when one encounters God. And this is a kind of trembling, a kind of awe and terror confronted with the ultimate power in the universe, as it were. And how does it feel? The creature feeling. And part of the problem with trying to describe Otto is he's trying to describe something that exists before conceptualization. So I'm trying to talk about something I can't describe and you can't understand unless you can experience it for yourself. Because it's not, you can't put this into a concept. So the best we're going to do is sort of gesture at a shadow on the wall, and if you recognize a similar shadow in your own memory, then you'll begin to relate to what we're talking about here. So.
Go ahead.
The Rudolf Otto talks about the mysterium tremendum, which is this feeling of both utter dependence and dread when encountering the holy. And this is something, right, it's something evoked. Right, you're walking along and all of a sudden you feel this thing in response to something else. And this is what he's talking about in the encounter with the holy. Okay. And one of the things that Otto talks about is, he says, one of the only things that's capable of getting close to this is music. And so he describes this piece, the Popule Meus. And it's a vocal old piece, many voices in an echoey space, and hearing this draws out feelings. But even this, he says, it's not actually the music itself, it's the silence around the music. Mm-hmm. And the silence around the music is when you approach this experience. So that was one of the pieces I was going to play. The other one is Requiem for Benjamin Britten by Arvo Pärt. And it's the point I'm trying to bring up here is encountering music that affects you in more than one level, let's say. You remember things, you feel things, you're connected to other, you know, very organic moments in your life that resonate. And I would draw back the whole an evening prayer and the building over there, where everybody in the room, it was like, oh, we're there, it's Vespers, da da da, and then this thing happened, and everybody kind of, and like the thing, whatever it was, it happened in there. There was something else in the room with everybody. And it, in my view, it came through the group, right? And it all was related to this vocal expression done in a ritual way. And so the point is to sort of bring us back to the Otto thing. If you can relate to what I'm talking about there because you've had a similar experience, then we're sort of talking about the same thing. And so we're not going to play either of those pieces today, but that's kind of the kind of, it's like what's here. If that makes any sense. Okay, so I want to just tell another quick little funny story. Okay, so right, heavy metal music. The Grateful Dead sounds like a heavy metal band. The story of the name has to do with a spirit that a person that has died and other people are abusing the dead person. They're not going to bury him. And a traveler comes along and sees this and decides to pay to have this person buried. And so then they go along some more and another traveler joins them and helps them with a task or a quest. And the point is that the Grateful Dead is the spirit who could not rest, and the living person has intervened for the dead to help them rest, and they return to say thank you. So the Grateful Dead is the restive spirit. So there's an ethical... Okay, so then I get into the thing about heavy metal. It sounds heavy metal band. The band Iron Maiden has this song called The Number of the Beast. When they came to tour in the United States, people, Christian groups started to protest and say this was Satan music. Satan was in the records. So they started to burn the records. And then somebody brought up the point, well, Satan's in the records and you're burning the records. Are you releasing Satan into the world? So they stopped burning them and just broke them. And the guys in Iron Maiden are very clear. They're not Satan worshippers. But so then just to sort of draw it all together, this is musicologist Robert Walzer. He says, if religion functions both to explain the world, providing models for how we live, tenets of faith, empowerment, and comfort for when they don't work, and to offer a sense of contact with something greater than oneself, then heavy metal surely qualifies as a religious phenomenon. So in my roundabout way, all of this is to say that I see religious dimensions in popular music. They relate to the origins of music in human society. They relate to the aesthetic development of forms like opera and symphony and hymns, and of course also the blues and other sort of extra-cultural manifestations of people trying to negotiate their experience and give voice to what it feels like to be oppressed, repressed, and alienated in society. And also to say that there's traces of this in all of Western popular music because of the history of the founding of this country and the development of our industries and so on and so forth. And also to say that certain genres and musicians begin to function as role models or idols, but more importantly, that participating in something like heavy metal or hip-hop or the Grateful Dead can provide for people a sense of meaning in the world, a negotiating factor that helps them to survive. Do we want to sing a song?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sorry, two more quotes. it's too bad he left, because he would have loved this. Through the songs, black slaves affirm the universal dimensions of the human spirit and its transcendence over the vicissitudes of life. That's James Cone from The Spirituals and the Blues, and I always have to include Mick Jagger, because he said it's stupid to think you can start a revolution with a record. And now, last time, I tried to sing this with Lutherans. They told me they didn't know the song. So,
I know it.
Okay.
I'm not Lutheran, so.
Do you know it?
No.
Okay. So.
You might when you hear it.
Last time I was this whole group of people, and I was like, surely you know this. And they were all like, you never heard it before. So, this is a song that the Grateful Dead would often finish their shows with. And that's how I always had heard it. And then, I guess it was a Methodist person said they used to sing this at camp. It was either a camp song. And then I was like, oh.
I think they changed it as Lay Down My Dear Brother.
Yeah. That's
my
why.
My friend just had it sung at his memorial service.
I put people in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there is a version of this at a Lutheran camp in North Dakota.
Oh. Good.
The words are slightly different, but it's
yeah.
Almost exactly the same.
Good. So, should
Karen
we try
Neville
to sing it?
Let's do it.
Okay. So I will try it. If, lay down, my dear brothers, people, lay down and take your rest. Won't you lay your head upon your Savior's breast? I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you. And we bid you good night, good night, good night. And we bid you good night, good night, good night. Keep going. And we bid you good night, good night, good night. Hey, for the ark, that wonderful boat.
Good night, good night.
Before the beast at the ending of the wood.
Good night. Good night. Good night.
And he ate all the children that would not be good.
Good night. Good night. Good night.
Walking in Jerusalem good just night. Like John.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.
And once more.
Lay down, my dear people, lay down and take your rest. Won't you lay your head upon your Savior's breast? I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best.
And we bid you good night,
good night.
Good night.
I have the chords up on my desk. Anybody wants it?
The what?
The chords. What?
The chords?
Sorry.
Oh, nice.
So there you go. I'm here till Friday, but I will answer questions or etc. And I will put on this in case anybody wants to hear. Yeah.
We may have to turn it back on if it's been a while.
Oh.
I'll go check though.
So thank you for coming. Tomorrow, social change and music.